It's great to be back. Thank you. It's good to see all of you guys. I've been very grateful for the questions and the interaction and the engagement. It's been wonderful. Of course, as the teacher, you always learn the most. And I feel like I'm encountering Lewis afresh. And that just keeps happening. In some ways, Lewis is kind of like what the whole Christian life is like, where you just return to the gospel afresh and you just find deeper and deeper wells and resources there that you didn't know before. And that's just the nature of the gospel. And Lewis is kind of like a little reflection of that, because returning to him at this stage of my own intellectual life, I am finding some new avenues. And today we're going to look at some of those as we look at Lewis the writer. We've talked about Lewis the man. We've talked about Lewis the theologian, his profound impact, his imaginative traction. We've talked about Lewis the ethicist, how he has this very profound understanding of oughtness as essential to our human condition. We've talked about Lewis the positive apologist, his very human apologetics that draw us in. We've talked about Lewis the negative apologist and how the mystery of the cross becomes the crux of how he understands answering the problem of evil. We looked at that last week. But today we're going to be looking at Lewis the writer. And to do this, I want to take a look at two of his most underappreciated forms of writing, both of which are typically thought of as the opposite ends on the spectrum of writing: Lewis's academic writing and Lewis's poetry. So both of these, really, you think of like a writer, you think of someone that writes academic prose. That's a technical approach to writing. And then you think about the poet who's paying attention to the aesthetic dynamics of language. I think by looking at these two opposite ends of the spectrum of Lewis's writing, what we're going to see is that Lewis had a certain kind of power in his writing that merged these two. And so we're going to see how this kind of works today as we look at Lewis the academic writer and Lewis the poet. We did take a little bit of a look at Lewis the poet last week, and it was like, oh, we've got to go back here. This is so good. And his academic writing is the kind of stuff you never hear when you do C.S. Lewis classes. It's that like, oh yeah, he was also an Oxford Don, you know, and wrote stuff, highfalutin stuff. Well, what was that highfalutin stuff that he wrote? We're going to take a look at that this morning. All right. Although best known for his Christian apologetics and his popular literature, Lewis produced very serious scholarship. Remember, his day job was that as an Oxford Don, and also he spent the last decade of his life at Cambridge. They call it Oxbridge. So he was wrapped up in Oxbridge. And he was at Cambridge as the chair of medieval and Renaissance literature. It was a chair that they actually created, Cambridge created, in order to lure Lewis over to Cambridge. So good for Cambridge, you know. So Lewis's focus as an academic was on Old and Middle English texts from the 11th to the 15th century. He did have a specialization in Spenser, who's from the 16th century, and Milton, 17th century. And so it's really hard, it's impossible really, to do justice to all of his scholarly achievements. But what I do want to do is I want to pay attention to four of his important works as a kind of a window into Lewis the academic. And we'll start off with Lewis's work, The Allegory of Love. Important here among his works is The Allegory of Love. Neville Coghill described Lewis's The Allegory of Love as an explosion that took place in literature faculties throughout Britain. When this thing was released, it blew open all the different literature faculties throughout the academic world in Britain. He writes, when we recovered and shook off the dust, we began to look around to see whether any of the comfortable old landmarks were still standing. And in The Allegory of Love, Lewis actually, what he does is he explores courtly love. Courtly love is a study in courtly love. Courtly love is this paradigm of love in the Middle Ages, whereby we see the courtly lover must serve a woman as this paragon of beauty and virtue. And the woman remains remote, aloof, unavailable to the lover. So you think of Dante's love for Beatrice, right? This always reaching, who is this Beatrice? Like, he's always going for Beatrice, or Petrarch for Laura, or Lancelot for Guinevere. These are all examples of courtly love. So Lewis pioneered approaching and also resuscitating major poets in the late Middle Ages in light of courtly love. Now, courtly love as a paradigm for looking at literature from the Middle Ages has fallen on hard times. But Lewis's work in the allegory of love has still remained important for a number of reasons. First, Lewis pioneered work on Roma de la Rose, which, if you know anything about the Middle Ages and literature in the Middle Ages, Roma de la Rose is probably the third most important work besides for the Bible and Consolations of Philosophy from Boethius. And so Lewis actually brought that into the forefront and did groundbreaking work on this important text in that time. He takes up writers who before Lewis were considered obscure as just footnotes, and he elevates them and shows their importance. He has a chapter on Spenser here and the Faerie Queen, which, like all of Lewis's work on Spenser, is considered very important for the field. And he suggested a revolutionary reading of Chaucer. Indeed, John Fleming writes, "Chaucer studies have more or less remained where Lewis put them in 1936 with the allegory of love." So some solid scholarship with the allegory of love. Let's see here. Lewis also produced a preface to Paradise Lost. Paradise Lost is John Milton's work, of course. And this has been described as Lewis's masterpiece of literary criticism. In Paradise Lost, it's long been noted how compelling the lines are that the devil gives, right? It makes me think of Rolling Stones' song, Sympathy for the Devil, right? That's what happens when you read Paradise Lost. You get this sympathy for the devil. The devil is someone that you can actually sympathize with. But what's amazing is that Lewis comes to Paradise Lost, and he overthrows William Blake's long-held idea that Milton had a certain kind of sympathy for the devil, that Milton was actually, quote, of the devil's party without knowing it. And Lewis is so deeply offended, not only does he take William Blake to task, but he's so deeply offended because Lewis knows that to make this kind of judgment about Paradise Lost shows that you're completely out of touch with the era in which Milton was writing. Lewis showed that Milton had actually achieved something very different than what Blake said. This is because Milton was writing with a very different kind of epic in mind than Virgil. As Lewis famously starts the preface to Paradise Lost, "The first qualification for judging any piece of workmanship from a corkscrew to a cathedral is to know what it is, what it was intended to do, and how it is meant to be used." And from there, he goes after Blake and says, "Of course, if you're reading from a modernist perspective, you're going to completely miss what Milton is doing." And what was he doing? Namely, he was writing a particular genre of epic that fits with Milton's particular universe, one marked by a favorable view of hierarchy and a deep understanding of the medieval view of pride, as well as an understanding that when someone talks about virtue, that you have to understand what their motives are behind that. There's always some kind of deep investment in that. And so Lewis then completely pulls Blake's view apart. Another important work of Lewis, academic work, The Discarded Image. Published posthumously, this is a work of intellectual history. The entire focus is on the brilliance of the pre-Enlightenment, medieval, and Renaissance world. The image is what is often called worldview, or what the French call le historie des mentalités, or what Charles Taylor refers to as the social imagination. Basically, it's the mental structures that guide the thinking of a period. Okay. By the way, as Christians, we use the word worldview way too much. I just want to kind of give us a little encouragement. Like, worldview is helpful. There's a whole other talk. I want to do another series on Abraham Kuyper. He introduced the word worldview into North America in 1905. He actually used the word world and life view, which was a broader concept than simply a conceptual apparatus, but the idea that ideas always are embodied. And so that's why I think the French term, le historie des mentalités, or what Charles Taylor calls social imagination, captures a little more, and I think maybe closer to actually how we think as Christians. That's a side subject. But what Lewis is doing here is he's showing that this image, okay, this what we'd call worldview or this social imagination, or this mentality, okay, has been discarded, and he's saying it's been discarded, but there's a tragedy in that because there's something that we are discarding that has deep treasures, ways of perceiving the world that we do not catch. And what is it that's been discarded? It's the pre-modern understanding of the universe as having the earth at its center and human beings being the central reality on earth as being created by an omnipotent and immanent God. And so you might say, but science has told us otherwise. right? We have a heliocentric universe, right? So why would this be of value? Well, whether or not we have a heliocentric or an Earth-centered universe, there is a much more important game at stake, which Lewis is pointing out, which is the idea of what do we call the universe? Do we call it a home or do we call it an empty space? And you'll see that with the arrival of deism in the 17th and 18th century, the universe is more and more spoken of as empty space. In other words, there's a lack of any kind of plot structure, narrative, or meaning, or meta-narrative behind that. And I went to an art exhibit last night, which the theme was home. And there's all this artworks, and it was paying attention to all the artifacts that we surround ourselves with and that we arrange. And the thing that was powerful about this was it's a microcosm of what Christians believe about the macrocosm of the universe. The universe is not just empty space. The universe is a home. And that's a profoundly radical view, but you know, it has ecological implications. Huge. So Lewis was onto this, by the way. In his poetry, he does ecology as well. But so Lewis is saying there's something we've lost when we discarded this image, this medieval understanding of the world, of the universe as a home. It's not an empty space. And it's a phenomenal introduction. John Fleming writes, "I know of no better introduction to the fundamental assumptions undergirding the medieval and Renaissance literature of Christian Europe than the discarded image." Yeah, it's really, really good. Is this where he has Pseudo-Dionysius, I think? There's a section on Pseudo-Dionysius in there. Angelic hierarchies, you know, and what does it mean? We no longer think like this, you know, because we live in a democratic age where we no longer think of hierarchy as having any value. But that puts us in tension with the Bible, okay? There's parts of that, you know, where we are imposing. So we no longer think of angels and archangels, you know, but that stuff's in scripture. And Lewis is saying it might just be that not every social imagination is actually works with certain themes of the Bible. Each social imagination has resonances and dissonances, or maybe I should say, I'm not using the word worldview, notice that, I'm using social imagination. Social imagination is broader than a worldview, okay? We all have the social imagination of a democratic sensibility as Americans, North Americans, that have been through a democratic revolution. But we may have different worldviews regarding if you're an atheist or agnostic or a Christian. You see, so recognizing there's certain kinds of allegiances come from that terminology. Hey, you can get college credit for today. I don't know why I'm getting abstract. Let's bring it down. Okay, let's keep it on the bottom shelf. Some of you are like, oh boy, what did I do? What did I do? Maybe, can I sneak out? Okay, I'll try to keep it on the bottom shelf. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, but Pseudo-Dionysius is totally, you got to read Pseudo-Dionysius sometime. Phenomenal. He had a huge impact on Aquinas. Aquinas had a huge impact on Calvin. Calvin had a huge impact on our tradition, which is Congregationalist, but huge impact on Protestantism. All right, English literature in the 16th century. Now this is kind of like Lewis is basically rolling up his sleeves, and everybody that's in academia knows that sometimes you just have to produce something like this. The reality is, though, Lewis actually wasn't obligated in the same way that modern academics are to produce major works like this. But this was him doing a service. This is part of the Oxford History of English Language series. You know, this is the kind of like stuff you do when you are an academic at Oxford, okay? And so Oxford History of English Language, if you just take the first four letters of that, you have O Hell. And that's what Lewis called this. He worked on it for 15 years, and he would joke around to his buddies that he had to leave. He had to go work on the Oh Hell. And, but this is the greatest single monument to Lewis's literary erudition. Like I said, it took 15 years for him to write it. His brilliant introduction, which is called New Learning and New Ignorance, offers what many consider to be the high watermark of the backdrop necessary to understanding the peculiar nature of humanism in Britain in the 16th century. Good books which are remote, this is Lewis, good books which are remote from modern sympathy need to be treated at greater length than good books which everyone already knows and loves. This is in his introduction, New Learning and New Ignorance. Bad books may be of importance for the history of taste, and if they are passed over too briefly, the student's picture of a period may be distorted. So this shows you two things about Lewis. Number one, Lewis thinks, and this is going to be a theme we're going to pull out in this lecture. Lewis is constantly challenging people to be aware of their natural postures. their natural postures, their intellectual postures, the things that are familiar, the things that feel comfortable. If you spend your whole life avoiding those things which might put you in tension, you're going to miss a lot of reality. And so Lewis here is talking about, if you go to study a period, okay, don't just study the books that everybody knows and loves. Look at the books that you may not be drawn to. By the way, I've challenged this class before. If you're a Christian, I would encourage you, go when you open your Bible, I would challenge you to look at the books in the Bible that you avoid, the ones you haven't read in a long time. Lewis would say, go for those. Spend some time in those, because that is going to show your blind spot. If you're somebody that just God is a God of such love and you're extremely tender soul and you can't imagine God's judgment, read the prophets. Spend some time where the prophets are like calling down fire, all right? If you're the person that calls down fire, don't spend so much time in the prophets. Go over to John, you know, and start reading 1 John, you know. But be aware of yourself and your natural postures. And that's Lewis is saying, do that as a scholar. But Lewis also demonstrates that in his own, he probably got that out of his Christian life, right? Out of him being a Christian. Because as a Christian, we're called to embrace, I mean, that's part of being a part of a church, right? Is that we have to sit next to people and love people that are very different from us. And this is part of our own health. So Lewis draws this out here in the Oh Hell volume that he did. And he shows us the brilliance of his ability as a reader of Spencer in this. Many other things he does in English literature in the 16th century, excluding, it's the subtitle, the title is literally English literature in the 16th century, excluding drama. So you know it's an academic work when you throw excluding drama with a little comma at the end. Okay, so what's the moral of the story? Here's the moral of the story. Lewis was a model of Christian scholarship. I don't know if you ever thought about this, but what is the difference between being a scholar and a Christian scholar? I remember asking when I first started my first PhD, I asked one of my mentors, I said, what does it look like to be a Christian scholar? And what is the difference? And there were some really interesting things that came out of that. And I can tell by looking at Lewis's scholarship that Lewis took not just being a scholar, but being a Christian scholar very serious. And so we see some of these marks. One of them is that Lewis recognized the sphere of his craft, the sphere of his craft. While he may not display the same kind of distancing of his apologetic works from his highly academic works one finds in, say, like Paul Ricoeur. Now, Paul Ricoeur is part of the French laïcité school of thought, where you do philosophy. He was a Christian philosopher. Everyone should know who Paul Ricoeur is, but we don't, but that's too bad. But he was a Christian philosopher. Profound Christian philosopher who died in 2007, wrote some major stuff, okay? He was one of the, like, surviving Huguenots, you know, in France. But he would do his philosophy, hardcore philosophy, all right? And then over here, he would write his commentaries. That's part of the French traditions. That comes out of the French Revolution, the split between the world of religion and the world of the state, which you still see in French political life. But unlike Paul Ricoeur, Lewis doesn't have this radical distancing, but Lewis does recognize that there's different spheres, and when he steps into his academic sphere, his primary goal there is not to be an apologist. It's to develop understanding of English literature in the 16th century, right? And it's the same thing applies for us. If you are called to be a police officer, your job is not to evangelize day and night, though if opportunities permit, then that's great. But your primary focus is to keep people safe, to protect and to serve, et cetera, right? And that's okay. It doesn't mean that you rip that apart, but you know, if suddenly you're a terrible cop, but everyone's getting evangelized, that's not to the glory of God. And Lewis would have recognized that, right? If you're a terrible parent, but you preach the gospel to your kids till they're blue in the face, that's not to the glory of God. Like, step up and be a parent if you're a parent, right? I mean, so Lewis recognizes. Another character trait of his Christian scholarship is civility. Civility. He had a certain generosity toward his intellectual adversaries, which is really, really good. You know, Lewis had the capacity to engage in serious differences without becoming an ugly person. Wow, that is incredibly important. Something our culture no longer has the capacity to do. Maybe we need to do a whole talk on civility. That might be the next series, right? My mentor, Dr. Richard Mao, who was the president at Fuller, wrote a whole book on Christian civility. the lost virtue of Christian civility. Lewis was marked by this. Now, this is really interesting, and we're going to see this when we get into Lewis's poetry. But one of Lewis's major interlocutors was T.S. Eliot, right? And T.S. Eliot and Lewis, there was some tension there, okay? And we'll get into that a little more in just a little bit. But Lewis writes this. If I make Mr. Eliot's words the peg on which to hang a discussion of this notion, this is him beginning to talk about, I can't remember what the subject was, beginning to talk about something, and he says, well, T.S. Eliot says this. And then he adds this little parenthesis. If I make Mr. Eliot's words the peg on which to hang a discussion of this notion, it must not, therefore, be assumed that this is, for me, more than a convenience, still less that I wish to attack him qua Mr. Eliot. Why should I? I agree with him about matters of such moment that all literary questions are, in comparison, trivial. So, like, this capacity to recognize the person that you're engaging with and to not get personal. And this is hard. It's really hard. Social media has shown we all come up short in this area. And that's a whole thing. We need to do a whole thing on social media, too. But, okay. All right. So, some more observations regarding Lewis the academic. I already mentioned his erudition. He knew about as much as could possibly be known from reading the primary sources in his field. He had a supremely supple imagination. He had a certain historical sympathy. He was able to make surprising, illuminating connections with various categories and showed a vast learning. In other words, he was a good scholar. He just didn't show up and see it as an opportunity to evangelize. He took serious what he was doing. As the scripture says, whatever you do, do it heartily as unto the Lord. He did it heartily. He embraced that. And we need Christians that are going to enter into their field and produce excellence, that are going to abandon themselves to that field to know it better than anybody else. This is why we are still reading Lewis, is because he wasn't doing, excuse me, crappy work. If he was doing crappy work, we wouldn't be having a class on him right now. But he applied himself to his craft and gave himself to it. Another mark, articulation. He had a remarkable capacity to put things into felicitous language in ways that were unique. It helps if you're a master of English. I mean, he really knew English. It helps if you also have Latin and Greek, like down, where you're like writing poems in Latin, you know, where you're going straight, when you start getting interested in Christianity, you go straight to the Greek text, okay? That helps. He has a capacity with languages. But he'd internalized these original languages, and he had a vivid sense of what the original languages said. So Lewis scholars often note that Lewis's prose is so good with his academic writing, because Lewis has a certain kind of concision and clarity of articulation. And that's what, if you work at writing, you'll notice that Lewis has this capacity to say things in their very simplest form, not always just big, long abstractions, right? I'm looking at Bob Verberg, who used to teach English. Like, it's really important. If you can't say it simply with clarity, then you're not a good writer. You need to be able to do that, right? And then you also need to be able to put together very complex ideas in a way that someone can follow. So he's able to do that. He had the capacity, and we've mentioned this, but he had a capacity to enter into an epoch that was unique. He was an intellectual historian. And what that means is that he was able to follow and trace the history of ideas. And we need more Christians that are intellectual historians. Or maybe I should say it this way. We all need to become more in tune with the way in which predominant thoughts shift over time, especially the more we enter into a post-Christian age, in which, and I'm talking about North America here, where the fundamental assumptions of our culture are more and more not our assumptions, okay? If you were in the first service and heard Pastor Josh preach on the difficult sayings of Jesus regarding sexual ethics, to me it was like, wow, I'm so grateful that we have somebody getting up and giving such a compelling and articulate presentation of what Jesus is really saying, you know, because we're hearing less and less of that today in our world. And there's reasons for that. And to understand why those reasons are there, which is a whole nother, I mean, Freud's influence in Lewis's 20th century, we're still living with, you know, we're seeing now that kind of working itself out with a lot of the, all the stuff that's going on today. So he had this capacity to enter into an epoch. In many ways, this is the mark of what he accomplished. In his own words, weaving the backcloth. He loved to weave the backcloth of a literary work. And so when you're looking at principal works in the medieval Renaissance literature like Dante or Milton or Spencer, Lewis had this capacity to enter into the thought world of that epoch, not only as a scholar, but as one intellectually convinced of the major ways of thinking in that epoch. Now, this is where it gets interesting. See, Lewis himself realized that he was something, he was odd. That he was someone who actually did not buy into the major assumptions of the epoch he lived in. And he'd immersed himself in a different epoch with some of the brightest and best minds, and he recognized that that was his true home, intellectually. It's quite a place to find yourself in. Lewis says that that if you actually find yourself convinced within another epoch, you are the best person to study that epoch. As the student of Milton, my Christianity is an advantage. What would you not give to have a real live Epicurean at your elbow while reading Lucretius? If you're a Christian, the good news is some of the greatest works that have been produced in Western culture will feel native to you, right? Milton's Paradise Lost or Dante's Divine Comedy. You already have an inside. And Lewis was convinced of the epoch. So what does this come to? Well, one of the things that you see emerging with Lewis's idea here about the importance here of actually having a certain kind of love for what you're studying, that that's important, is, and that's a very strange thing to say, right? But in the middle of the 20th century, the height of modernism, where there's this kind of idea of objectivity, where if you could stand back and critically see everything, Lewis is saying something very different. He's saying having a critical distance where you separate yourself from something, that actually keeps you from knowing it in certain ways. And that if you actually have a love and affinity with something, you're going to be able to understand it much clearer, right? This is a radical thing for him to say. But what he's talking about here is something that, scholar N.T. Wright calls the hermeneutics of love. The hermeneutics of love. To understand the meaning of certain things requires certain postures. And I know this isn't the kind of thing you should say in a university, because we have this naive, in the postmodern university, now we've gone the opposite side, right? Now it's all about power. It's a hermeneutics of power and who gets to declare what somebody is saying. In the modern period, in the height of modernism, it was who gets to distance themselves and be the supreme reasonable self that gets to then impose reason upon whatever is being said. But Lewis is going back to the pre-modern understanding that knowledge at the end of the day requires a certain kind of posture of humility and affinity. It's actually what causes us to know somebody in a personal relationship. If someone wants to get to know you, they're going to have a certain posture towards you, and they need to show a certain kind of affinity. And if they don't, you won't let them get to know you. And so Lewis here says that, and this is one of the key character traits that emerges, he wants to disabuse his age of the idea that knowledge is something that is available to everybody just by virtue of applying reason. There's an awful lot you won't know. And then Lewis even goes farther and says that, and if you don't have any kind of sympathy for the subject you're studying, you are the worst possible person to be a scholar in that field, which I really appreciate this. I did some doctoral work at the Free University in Amsterdam. And one of the things that I liked about the program there is the people that are teaching in the religious studies programs, the person that's teaching the Quran is a Muslim. The person that's teaching Christianity, like my doctoral mentor, loves Jesus. You know, he loves Jesus. And he's teaching systematic theology, you know. And that's the person you want to have. A person that has, because there's a certain kind of window. If I come as someone that already has an oppositional view, there's something I'm not going to get. So Lewis had a profound, and by the way, that applies entirely to Scripture. There's so much of Scripture you will not get if your posture towards Scripture is already antagonistic. It's like the windows will be closed. The Bible will be a dead book to you. It's amazing. Lewis says, those who are not interested in an author's matter can have nothing of value to say about his style of construction. And of course, this has implications for all the Bibles literature classes that were thrown out there. Remember that? That whole thing? Bibles literature? You know, okay, great. You know, the idea that we can extract the Bible as just a piece of literature. There is something, Bible is literature, the Bible has genres, but there's also something suspicious that we're just going to treat the Bible just as literature when the Bible itself never made the claim to be just literature, but something much greater, right? And again, that would be like someone saying, well, I'm going to approach you as a specimen. Well, that's wonderful. I am a specimen. I have a body. I can be studied through the lens of science, but don't count on getting to know me because I don't think of myself primarily as a specimen. You know? All right. I don't know. I'm so philosophical today. All right. So Lewis is challenging the modernist bias. He's an intellectual historian who is challenging the modernist bias. And this is most clearly spelled out in Lewis's 1954 speech turned into an essay, De Descriptione Temporum, on the description of epochs. This was given at the installment of his as the new chair in medieval and Renaissance studies at Cambridge. Again, good job, Cambridge. Cambridge wanted to bring Lewis, and they invented a chair just to bring him there. So Lewis argues in this De Descriptione Temporum that dividing lines between medieval and Renaissance studies needs to be questioned. There is no easy way to divide these into two different epochs. And that binaries such as the Dark Ages and the modern period are just silly. That if you look at the way in which thought unfolds, it's never with such clear distinctions where you're starting a new period. He uses, by way of example, the first chapter of J.M. Burden's early Tudor poetry, which states, we begin with 29 pages, and they contain of unrelieved gloom and grossness, in which he says, the first rift in this darkness is the Copernican doctrine, as if, and Lewis writes, these first 29 pages of unrelieved gloom and grossness, superstition and cruelty to children, and this page that talks about the final rift between this gloominess and grossness with the Copernican doctrine is silly. It's as if a new hypothesis in astronomy would naturally make a man stop hitting his daughter about the head. Like, it wasn't like you have all this dark ages and this period of darkness and gloom and people are just, you know, backwards, and then suddenly there's this idea that, you know, of the Copernican doctrine, and suddenly all of life changes. That's just not the way the world works. Lewis even goes on and says, what is the real Dark Ages? He says, when ancient barbarians could not read Virgil, or when today's barbarians can't read Virgil? He writes, we've lived to see the second death of ancient learning. In our time, something which was once the possession of all educated men has shrunk to being the technical accomplishment of a few specialists. As for the area and the tempo of the two deaths, if one were looking for a man who could not read Virgil through his father, though his father could, he might be found more easily in the 20th century than in the 5th. Yeah, you can hear some angst here. Like, Lewis feels that we have lost the capacity, some very important capacities. And we've lost kind of the inheritance of some of the greatest thinking and some of those profound thought. And I know that there is, you can see where Lewis falls on this discussion, right? But Lewis really believed that it's a great tragedy that people were no longer immersed in some of the great classics, some of the brightest minds that had come before us. And I'm going to say unashamedly, as someone that used to teach in a humanities program, I completely agree with Lewis. I mean, if you are talking to somebody and they have no idea where they're getting their ideas, they have no, I mean, you'll talk to people, it's like, don't you understand you just parroted Machiavelli and you think you're being original? Like, these ideas were already dealt with, you don't even know that. And we should think this is good? This isn't good. These are people that are just cut off. They think, it's like meeting someone that thinks they've just invented Christianity for the first time. You know, you'll meet Christians and say, we don't need the creeds. Like, what? How naive are you? How arrogant are you that you think we can throw out all the greatest minds that have come before you, and why? Because you, like, wear skinny jeans? Like, how silly is this? So Lewis was deeply concerned with the way in which the inheritance of some of the brightest minds were just being thrown out. But Lewis then goes on in this speech. This is, again, at his installment at the chair. And he goes on and he says, if we really do want to draw a line, the line doesn't fall between medieval and Renaissance. The line falls between what would be called a pre-Christianity and post-Christianity in thought. And he draws it right around 1800. And he says there's a profound shift that takes place in Western culture around that time. And he says that that's where we see a completely different way of understanding the world emerge. And everything before 1800, you can take it all the way back. There's this great quote where Lewis says, non-Christians are not pagans. Calling a non-Christian a pagan is like believing that a woman, because she's divorced, is suddenly a virgin again. Like non-Christians are doubly removed from paganism. Think about that for a second. See, Christianity was the solution to paganism, right? But if you leave Christianity behind, you are now another step removed from the questions and concerns that the pagan world had raised. The pagan world, which didn't know how to treat people with dignity and with kindness, and didn't know how the world could not be reduced into a battle of the wills and power, in which the weak were snuffed out, in which it was a matter of a shouting match, in which you were attempting to bully and push other people around. Well, guess what? We are now living in a culture that is becoming more and more less influenced by Christianity. And what are we seeing? We're seeing Nietzsche. We're seeing everything being reduced to matters of power and people being reduced to identity politics. You know, where if you say something, who cares what you said? It's a matter of whatever tribe you're from imposing your position on me. So it's a shame we can't see what the pagans saw, because if the post-Christian world could see what the pagans saw, they would see how Christianity was the answer. They don't realize it. So in a certain sense, there's a new kind of paganism. In a certain sense, there isn't an awareness of that paganism. It's a shame that our post-Christian world's not more aware of the pagan world, because they would see that the questions they're beginning to raise all over again might have already been around. So I'm kind of preaching today. All right. I guess I'm moving back into preacher mode, so the class ends. All right. Okay. So Lewis is really concerned that there's this, we've left any kind of historical awareness behind, and he writes this. In the individual life, as the psychologists have taught us, it is not the remembered, but the forgotten past that enslaves us. I think the same is true of society. To study the past does indeed liberate us from the present, from the idols of our own marketplace. That's Bacon. But I think it liberates us from the past too. I think no class of men are less enslaved to the past than historians. The unhistorical are usually, without knowing it, simply enslaved to the fairly recent past. Isn't that so true? Like, how can you have any kind of awareness of the world you're living in and what are the fashionable ideas if you have no awareness of the past? You know, so helpful. One of the examples that Lewis gives, by the way, of this problem is in English literature in the 16th century. And Lewis there shows that far from the current criticism of Puritans as being prudish ascetics, in their own day they were blamed for being too sensual and life-affirming. That's our heritage here at this church, okay? And he quotes Thomas More. Roman Catholic Thomas More is stating, a Protestant is one drunk of lewd lightness of mind and vain gladness of heart. He's talking about Puritans here. So, you know, if you have no historical awareness, you can call the Puritans prudes. That just simply shows you don't know what you're talking about. Because within their own time and period, they were seen as these lighthearted people that embraced life, that enjoyed life, and that sucked the marrow out of life as part of their bold faith and part of their grace, right? So profound. And this, by the way, this need for historical awareness is one of the reasons why, and we interrupt for a commercial break, in our internship program here at Christ Church that I am running, we have our first 5 interns. This is what we're reading. We're reading classics. We're reading Julian of Norwich and Pseudo-Dionysius. We're reading the Valley of Vision, which is just these beautiful Puritan prayers. We're reading John Donne and George Herbert, and we're reading St. John of the Cross. And oh, there's C.S. Lewis in there, if you can look. Way to Glory, and some Dietrich Bonhoeffer and John Calvin. Sorry, I love John Calvin. people that boo John Calvin have not read John Calvin, I'm afraid. But anyways, just kidding. I mean, I bet people have read it. I'm like, how did you not just love that? Okay, so, but the point is that for every contemporary book, I have them read two classic books because it's easy for them to think in terms of identity politics. It's not hard for them to want to know about theology and race. That's a natural question for them, and that's a good question. Theology and gender, those are important questions. And the church needs to address those questions because they're pressing questions for our culture. But if we start there and we never leave there, what we've done is we've left people abandoned to the current wind that is so pressing, and we haven't immersed them actually in a radically different way of looking at the world. If you read Pseudo-Dionysius, you're in a completely different time and period. It's far more brave and challenging to read somebody from the 5th century than to read a contemporary who has a different view than you. Because you want to step outside of your mindset, go read St. Augustine, who's North African, okay? He's not North American, he's not Anglo. He's North African, he is biracial, he's bilingual, okay? He's living in a radically different time. The dominant form of influences are just so different. If you can immerse yourself in St. Augustine, you will revisit your own society and world in radically different ways. Same thing goes for Calvin, all these books. So, well, not all of them. You have Tim Keller at the top and the bottom, just because we like to preach the gospel here. All right. So, and by the way, this, by the way, is kind of the crazy making when you do know the history. When people say, oh, well, you're a Christian. Well, what about the Crusades? I'm always like, what are you talking about? Like, that's what do you mean by that? What about the Crusades? Well, what Christianity, they caused the Crusades. It's like, well, you know, I don't know if you know this, but the separation of church and state hadn't even been thought of yet. So it's kind of like blaming people in the 3rd century for not having the internet. Like, there was no other option. You know that, right? And by the way, the fact that you're asking about what about the Crusades just shows you don't even know your own indebtedness to Christianity. Because who said, you know, give unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's? That was Jesus. The fact that you can criticize Christianity because of the Crusades shows you don't even know you're borrowing the capital of Jesus, who centuries ago challenged the idea that the most powerful political authority is what establishes the religion. And so thank you very much for establishing my worldview by asking what about the Crusades, you know? And by the way, and you're welcome for the work that Christianity did in order to put you in the position where you can ask that question, right? But if you have no historical consciousness, then you don't even realize that you're criticizing something that you're actually indebted to. Okay. I am so preachy today. All right. Sorry. Okay, let's go to the other end of the spectrum. Lewis the poet. And we did get a chance, I don't need too much here, we did get a chance to do a little bit of Lewis's poetry last week. This has been, probably the reason I'm talking about this is because this has been the big aha this round for Lewis. Lewis, you just have to go in layers with Lewis. You just, you know, you do a little more, you do a little more, and then you just keep hitting more and more gold. The next time, I'm going to do the letters of C.S. Lewis. That's my next, I really haven't done justice to those. But this time I got into some of the poetry, and last week we looked at Lewis the searing, burning atheist, who was just, some of his early poetry, right, was so, like, you got the visceral Lewis. Like, oh, this guy really was an angry, angry atheist. But there's so many other things going on in his poetry. It's surprising. And you can see it there on the screen. I took my dust jacket off because I books are like my idol. Like, when someone borrows my book, it's like me, like, sending my daughter out somewhere. Like, you better, like, treat that book well. If anything happens to that book and it comes back damaged, it's not going to be good for you. Like, you know, my books are very personal. So I took my dust jacket off. I actually like went back and forth. Well, I could show them the dust, but it could get ruined in the bag. This is kind of the crisis I have in the morning, right, before I teach this class. But they have the slide of the dust jacket. So there's the dust jacket. So, and I actually just reached out to Don King. Facebook's amazing. You can just do a Facebook search. There he is. I sent him a personal message on a note. Thank you so much for your book. You know, what a world we live in, right? But the collected poems, it's not the complete poems. The collected poems, this is a great volume. It has blown my mind. I had seen a few, but the thing that's so fascinating is just there's all these Lewises you didn't know existed when you start reading his poetry. Interesting. I mean, he becomes a very round character. So we need to remember, as Owen Barfill writes, that for the first two centuries, poetry was Lewis's burning passion. His great ruling passion was to become a great poet. At that time, if you thought of Lewis, you automatically thought of poetry. So poetry was a huge part of Lewis's life. But then it raises the important question, like, why is poetry always seen as secondary to Lewis, right? In fact, why is it that Lewis is more known for him writing academic books like Milton and Spencer and The Allegory of Love, talking about other people's poetic works than his own? How can he have elevated other poets but not be able to save himself in his own poetry? Right? That's an interesting question. So what's going on? Well, Charles Hutter has stated that probably one of the things that contributed to Lewis's poetry not getting the attention that you would think it would get is that Lewis he had shunned modernism, which was a poetic movement that T.S. Eliot was in the middle of, right? And Lewis just very much self-designated himself as being anti-modernist in his poetry, even though there's aspects of Lewis's poetry that do show an awareness of the modern discussion, modernist discussion of poetry. So we know of T.S. Eliot as a poet, but we don't know of Lewis. And in fact, by age 30, it appears that Lewis had settled that he would not be a poet like he had hoped. Because his giant narrative poem, Dimer, which is a big fat poem, narrative poem, didn't have any, you know, didn't go off like he thought. Again, it's just like John Calvin wrote his commentary on Seneca with all the bells and whistles, and it just dropped dead. And he, like an identity crisis, I think Lewis had something similar happen. You know, he spent years and years working on this thing. So so Lewis then, at the same time, he can recognize that things are taking off for T.S. Eliot. So this is something that's very personal for him, right? Imagine this. You're a Christian, you want to be a poet, and your poetry doesn't catch, and then there's this guy named T.S. Eliot. So I wonder what God was doing in Lewis's life with T.S. Eliot. You know, there's probably a T.S. Eliot in your life where you're like, really, Lord? Like, I'm working just as hard. Like, why am I not? So, and Lewis actually wrote a verse. It kind of shows his frustration that his poetry doesn't catch and T.S. Eliot's does. And this is really, in a certain way, it's almost like a dig at Eliot, and particularly his poem, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. Lewis writes, "I am so coarse, the thing the poet sees are obstinately invisible to me. For 20 years, I've started my level best to see if evening, any evening, would suggest a patient etherized upon a table. In vain, I simply wasn't able." What's he saying here? So, in The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, T.S. Eliot has this capacity to dissect the internal workings, right? And he's looking at the modern urban individual, the person who's stricken with feelings of isolation and the incapacity for a decisive action and disillusionment. And so here's this modern person that T.S. Eliot develops through this introspection. And so Lewis is kind of digging at this. Like, I haven't gone in for this kind of like navel-gazing, we might say, that T.S. Eliot does. I can't see what they see. I don't see the value in that. It's not what I'm doing. And yet, I'm suffering from that, right? And so Lewis made Eliot and his poetry the locus and symbol of those aspects of the modern world he was trying to oppose and criticize. He had a number of public academic disputes with Eliot as a critic, particularly about Milton's place in the canon and modernism's dismissal of Romanticism. Later, Lewis and Eliot came to know one another very well. They reconciled many of their differences and found a great deal in common through and beyond their common conversion to the Christian faith. They were both Anglicans, after all. The more mature, nuanced Eliot was actually very much invested in reconciling the past with the present rather than leaving it behind. For example, Eliot's sustained conversation with Milton in Ode on the Morning of Christ's Nativity not only echoes Milton, but reimagines and recreates Milton in light of contemporary idioms. So Eliot was not content to simply repersonate the past. He wanted to bring together the past and the present. And in many ways, Lewis has a very similar sentiment. So they can almost be seen as like warring brothers. And if you really want to get into Lewis's poetry, you might want to read a little T.S. Eliot too, because you can see that there's this dialogue going on back and forth. So like I said, Lewis wrote a surprising amount of poetry. And during his lifetime, there are two volumes that were published, Spirits in Bondage, A Cycle of Lyrics, which he published when he was 17, his first publication, and then his longer narrative poem, Dimer. But he wrote other poems. They were published in journals under pseudonyms. He wrote 16 lyric poems that are included in The Pilgrim's Regress, and there's a bunch of poems scattered throughout his letters, his published journals, and magazines, and under the pseudonym N.W., which stands for not Wilk in Latin, which means I know not whom. Yes, there should be a whole talk on Lewis's pseudonyms, because they're so funny, you know. Malcolm Guite, who's an Anglican poet, who writes really great poetry, by the way. If you ever see his stuff, you should read it. He wrote a book on art that I disagree with, but he writes great poetry. He writes this, "The range is indeed astonishing. The lyrics cover everything from poetry of the Great War tinged with the influence of Yeats and the French symbolist to satiric verse and epigrams modeled on Horace and Juvenal. Robustuous pieces in the manner Chesterton, delicate elegies, complex metrics experiments, and imaginative pseudo-pagan panegyrics set alongside chastened meditative examples of classic Christian examine." That's his lyrics. Okay, let's talk about his narrative poems. "The range of the narrative verse is just as wide. Dimer is an emblematic self-made myth of rebellion, death, and resurrection written in 9 cantos of rhyme royale. The Queen of Drum is 5 cantos of mixed meter, strangely coming in contemporary political comment on the rise of fascism with a profound meditation on the place of fairy and hence the role of the imagination, both religious and public life. There's a long fragment of Arthurian verse called Lancelot, which is perhaps too indebted to Tennyson. And then a very fine poem in 742 lines of alliterative verse entitled by its editor, The Nameless Island, and dealing at depth and in rich symbolism with the reconciliation and concord of the divided powers of reason and imagination, which is a central theme in Lewis's work." So those were descriptions by Malcolm Guite, pretty good descriptions of both his lyric and his narrative verse. Let's just go over five basic categories. There's his early poems, retelling of Norse myths in the narrative style of Virgil and Milton. There's brooding poems, this is my title, brooding poems on nature's beauty, human suffering, and God's disconnection with both. So this is, you can see, this is him trying to reconcile his unbelief with his kind of draw towards romanticism. There's the narrative epic poem, Dimer. There's then lyric poems. These are found in The Pilgrim's Regress. I think there's 16 of them. Who here has read The Pilgrim's Regress? Awesome. Yeah, so he has these lyric poems, which is such an interesting thing to read a book and then have all these poems. A lot of times they're in the mouths of these different allegorical characters who are singing or saying something. Then there's later poems. Occasional verse, burlesque, and erudite satire are contemplative or religious poems musing on the human condition, pain, suffering, pride, meaning, and the spiritual life. And then the most touching ones, apex poems, include 3 sonnets dealing with joys, cancer, and subsequent death. And even poems where Lewis is looking back on his life and has these very touching and moving, profound queries about his expectation of what his life would have been. Lewis is okay with life not, you know, everything having a bow on it and wrapped up nice and neatly. Which is what I love about poetry. The nature of language itself is that it's open-ended. The nature of, is that that's how it actually attaches to us, is the metaphorical quality of all language. So let's take a look at just a couple poems, and then I do want to leave a little bit of time for Q&A. How did I choose these poems? I chose these poems based on, I think, what they tell us about Lewis's own journey as a writer, his own unique contribution, and based on what we've kind of been talking about, Lewis's own problem of being stuck in the wrong epoch. As he says, "I am a dinosaur." When he's installed in the chair of medieval restlessness, he says, "I'm a dinosaur. Like, look at me, because my way of viewing the world is so radically from a different epoch. And study me, because we're dying out. I'm the last of my kind. So this is called, the poem is called The Country of the Blind, and it's taken off of that saying that in the land of the blind, one eye is king. And Lewis is saying, nope, that's not my experience. I have one eye into another epoch, and it doesn't feel very kingly. It feels actually quite the opposite. Hard light bathed them, a whole nation of eyeless men, dark bipeds, not aware how they were maimed, a long process, clearly a slow curse, drained through centuries, left them thus. At some transitional stage, then, a luckless few, no doubt, must have had eyes after the up-to-date normal type had achieved snug darkness, safe from the guns of heaven, whose blind mouths would abuse words that belonged to their great-grandsires, unabashed, talking of light in some eunuched, etiolated, fungoid sense, as a symbol of abstract thoughts. If a man, one that had eyes, a poor misfit, this is Lewis, spoke of the great dawn or the stars or green-sloped sea waves, or admired how warm tints changed in a lady's cheek. None complained he had used words from an alien tongue. No questioned. It was worse. All would agree. Of course, came their answer. We've all felt just like that. They were wrong. And he knew too much to be clear, could not explain. The words, sold, raped, flung to the dogs, now would avail no more. Hence, silence. But the mold warps, with glib confidence, easily showed how tricks of the phrase, sheer metaphors, could set fools concocting a myth, taking the words for things. Do you think this is a far-fetched picture? Go then, about among men now famous, attempt speech on the truths that once, opaque, carved in divine forms, irremovable, dread but dear as a mountain, mass, stood plain to the inward eye. This is a heartbreaking poem about what it's like to be a Neanderthal in a land of modernists, where you can see things, and Lewis could see things because he had been immersed in the medieval period, that no one else could see. And then when he opened his mouth and he spoke of those things, other people couldn't hear, which is actually the truth. The truth of the matter is that, I mean, it's actually kind of an experience as a Christian, I think. When you've been illuminated by the Holy Spirit, you keep speaking English, but you can see things that people around you can't see. And then they want to impose their own language or ideas upon what it is that you're saying. You know? So Lewis is talking about this experience, what it's like to be a medievalist, to be a dinosaur, to be an academic Neanderthal who's rejected modernism. But also as a poet, maybe, whose poetry has been missed. So you hear also this kind of theme with T.S. Eliot and modernism and how his poetry was missed. It's a poem that develops the idea that in the land of the blind, the one eye is not king, but just simply luckless. A luckless fellow who people say, yes, yes, we get it, but they remain unseen. I want to recommend you spend some time with The Country of the Blind. Again, these are just teasers. I'm just teasing you right now. Poetry's so rich, right? You're not going to get it on the first round. People are like, I didn't get that. Like, of course you didn't get it. This isn't a amuse-bouche, okay? That's all it is. I'm just kind of like trying to whet your appetite so you go into the poetry here. I like this one. This is really appropriate for paradoxes. This is the Apologist's Evening Prayer, okay? All of you wannabe apologists that are Hugh Ross groupies, listen up. For all my lame defeats and oh, much more from all the victories that I seem to score, from cleverness shot forth on thy behalf, at which, while angels weep, the audience laugh. From all my proofs of thy divinity, thou who wouldst give no sign, deliver me. Thoughts are but coins, let me not trust, instead of thee. Oh, you need another one. Thoughts are but coins, let me not trust, instead of thee, their thin worn image of thy head. From all my thoughts, even from my thoughts of thee, O thou fair silence, fall and set me free. Lord of the narrow gate and the needle's eye, take from me all my trumpery, lest I die. the inadequacy of words to communicate who God is, of words to communicate to other people in arguments, the inadequacy of words, which is something that every poet knows. They're stretching the language to its breaking point. That's what poetry is. Poets' job is to help us to understand the very range of language, what it can and can't do, and to hopefully push it a little farther for humanity's sake, right? And that's what Lewis would do. But if you're in that job, if that's your job, you realize the limitation of words. And anybody that's a writer comes up to this like, you know, we all recognize it, right? And yet that's all we have. And at the end of the day, apologetics, I love this prayer because at the end of the day, sometimes it's God's silence. I mean, all your great arguments at the end of the day are not going to win the day. You know, I think Gresham Machen said that the ultimate apologetic is just simply your life. The silence of a life well lived has a power that all the words can never contain. So I love that. Here's a very similar theme, a footnote to all prayers. He whom I bow to only knows to whom I bow. He whom I bow to only knows to whom I bow. When I tempt the ineffable name, murmuring thou, and dream of Fadian fancies and embrace in heart symbols I know which cannot be the thing thou art. Thus always, taken at their word, all prayers blaspheme, worshiping with frail images a folklore dream. This is hard for us as Protestants. And all men in their praying, self-deceived, address the coinage of their own unique, unquiet thoughts. Unless thou in magnetic mercy to thyself divert our arrows, aimed unskillfully beyond desert, and all men are idolaters, crying unheard to a deaf idol, if thou take them at their word. Take not, O Lord, our literal sense. Lord, in thy great unbroken speech, our limping metaphors translate. This is a profound thought, again, about how we can put too much confidence in our own words, in our prayers. You know, that the Spirit groans inside of us with words, with groanings too deep for words, and that's where prayer begins. It begins at that level, not at the level of, you know, being eloquent. And at the end of the day, all prayer leaves words behind. And if we don't leave words behind, then we're practicing idolatry. Profound. All right, let's bring the horses in the stable. Just too much good stuff. Okay. Lewis's poetry is powerful precisely because it is one more place where we see him integrating reason and imagination. Now, Lewis, the funny thing is that Lewis's poetry didn't take off, but Lewis's prose took off precisely because it's so poetic. You read Lewis's prose because it's poetic. There's better people that do apologetics these days if you want arguments. But you'll keep reading Lewis because he says it so beautifully. And that's a lesson, like, at the end of the day, we are aesthetic creatures. It's irreducible. It's part of our constitution. And the gospel should be beautiful. It's not enough for it to be factually correct. And I say that as a theologian that wants it to be correct. So Lewis's lifelong project, be it an academic prose or apologetics, was to bridge reason and the imagination. And this came from Lewis's own sense that in the mid-20th century, he was stuck between the two. As he writes, such then was the state of my imaginative life. Over against it stood the life of my intellect. The two hemispheres of my mind were in the sharpest contrast. On the one side, a many-island sea of poetry and myth. On the other, a glib and shallow rationalism. Nearly all that I loved, I believed be imaginary. Nearly all that I believed to be real, I thought grim and meaningless. And so I'm going to close our class with this poem from Lewis called Reason, in which he talks about how you need both reason and the imagination. Sit on the soul's acropolis, the reason stands, a virgin armed, commercing with celestial light. And he who sins against her has defiled his own virginity. No cleansing makes his garment white. So clear is reason. But how dark, imagining, warm, dark, obscure and infinite, daughter of night, Dark is her brow, the beauty of her eyes with sleep is loaded, and her pains are long, and her delight. Tempt not Athena, wound not in her fertile pains Demeter, nor rebel against her mother right. Oh, who will reconcile in me both maid and mother? Who make in me a concord of depth and height? Who make imagination's dim exploring touch ever report the same as intellectual sight? Then could I truly say and not deceive, then wholly say that I believe. Lewis did believe. He believed with head and heart. He believed with reason and imagination. He believed with academic writing and with poetry. And for all of our benefit, he believed with popular works that were beautiful. Thank you very much. We do have some time for Q&A, about 8 minutes. Yes, Bob.
So a couple of questions that are kind of related to the same thing. What would you say to a person that said, because of your love for the subject, you cannot possibly be objective when you study the subject? And yeah. Then a kind of related question would be, what is it that you gain from your love of subject that you would not gain otherwise?
Those are great questions. Yeah, really good questions. So the person that say, because of your love of the subject, you can't be objective, I would just simply say, well, when you say objective, what do you mean? Because there is no nowhere. Everybody is coming at something from a somewhere. And so I'm just simply saying that I'm coming from a somewhere where I have previous experience that draws me into the subject and helps me to relate to the subject. And so I like the question a lot. What was the second half of the question?
What is it about your love for the subject that gives you insight more than somebody else?
What is it about your love for the subject that gives you insight more than somebody else? And I would say that, of course, there's the way in which if you love something, you're propelled to know it. But I think that this is part of the mark of viewing the world as ultimately about persons in communion. When we talked about Lewis's theology, the Trinity, right? The ultimate reality is persons in communion. The ultimate reality is not dead, empty space, that it's persons in communion. And if you believe that, then you believe that knowing at the end of the day always involves postures. And so part of it is just simply part of my Christian, well, he'll say worldview or... I'll say worldview. Part of my Christian worldview is that there's a certain posture that is part of all knowing. And I would even say, like, I have a friend who's an ecologist, and he lives out in nature. I love reading his posts because he views the natural world with lenses that I don't have because he's passionate. You know who I'm talking about. He's passionate, right? He's kind of a St. Francis of Assisi kind of guy, right? He's like a John Muir kind of guy. He has such a love for nature, and that's drawn him deeper. And as he's drawn deeper, he's gotten to know nature more, and then that's then fueled his love. And this kind of cycle is actually how all knowledge really works. People that love mathematics, they have some success with math, so they're propelled on. And maybe that's what happened with me. It didn't work. You know, I never fell in love with it. But people that have a love for math, they know math. They really know math, and they have a certain kind of protection. Like if you don't get math, they feel a little wounded because they see it in ways that you don't see it. You can't pull it apart. Knowledge always has the human element. So, yes.
Did C.S. Lewis go through periods of poetry, academic prose, like Picasso had a blue period, or was he writing everything all the time part of who he was?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a mix of both, right? Sometimes he had major things that had to get done, but he always, a great writer always kind of has something going on, right? There are times where we saw, particularly in the 40s, where he was just writing so many different things. And always spinning things off and applying things in different directions. I mean, he had such a fertile mind. But there were times where he had to focus and get things done, and there were times where he had multiple projects happening simultaneously. And because he cared about the craft of writing, whether he was doing academic work or poetry, he could embrace all those different genres with a certain seriousness and not feel like he was, you know, unlike most of us where it's kind of like you have your one or two things you're good at, you know, and if you imagine being having three things, how can you do them all at the same time? I think Lewis was just so capable. He could carry on multiple things simultaneously that would be very different kinds of projects. It's incredible is really what it is.
My question was, you know, he was lamenting the fact that so much had been lost since the Middle Ages and that we've lost our historical awareness. And I was wondering, to what extent was he involved or influenced by any political philosophers of his time? Because it struck me that there was a philosopher during his lifetime, Leo Strauss, that I think had a similar understanding. Like he was going back to the ancient Greeks, and Aristotle in particular, that then influenced the medieval period for sure, and mm-hmm. just seemed like they were kindred spirits in some mm-hmm. respect. So I was just curious to what there might be a connection with political philosophers of his time.
Next time we do Lewis, I want to dive into that because I think that's a very, very interesting question. Of course, Lewis is going to be much more sympathetic to hierarchy than we would be because we don't understand it, right? And so that doesn't mean that Lewis wouldn't want to embrace democracy, but he wouldn't do it in a way in which he maybe put a kind of stake in democracy that we might. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, I think we can naively assume if we just spread democracy around, then the world just, you know, everybody joins hands. And because if you don't understand the history, you don't understand not only the gains, but the losses. Because with every development in history, there tends to be gains and losses. And I think Lewis could see the losses and not just the gains. And he could bemoan those losses in ways which we can't understand because we're not as immersed.
And just one other comment. When you were reading the Country of the Blind, it reminded me of Plato's Allegory of the Cave, where people mistake the shadows for reality. You have a man who crawls out, is in the light, sees what reality really is like. Mm-hmm. But in the modernist period, it's as if we've walked back into the cave without realizing it. Another version of the Country of the Blind.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's really good. I'll have to go back and reread it with that vantage point. Thank you for that.
Now, I was just wondering about Lewis before he became a Christian and then afterwards, and how, as we read him, we see the Christianity in him now. And because of that, that builds a bond between us and him as Christians, but only as Christians, because the Holy Spirit does that to us. And I guess it's more just of a comment than a question, but there seems to be a definite difference from before and after that we all experience with him, I suppose.
Yeah. I'll be honest with you. I think one of the reasons I wanted to introduce C.S. Lewis is because Lewis has the capacity to make our Christianity strange again. And one of the problems when you've been a Christian for a number of years is your Christianity is no longer strange to you. And it should be strange. And when it becomes comfortable and familiar, I think it's not the kind of New Testament Christianity we see, where people are awakened to the radicalness of who Jesus is. And Lewis now can offer us a capacity to see kind of the depths and glory of he's a great guide into recognizing that our faith is not everything we've wound it up to be, that there are other vistas. It doesn't matter how old you are or young you are, there are more vistas. And until we enter into the, until we're willing to step into our faith being not only comfortable but deconstructed, for it to be reconstructed. I mean, that's really the Christian life, is the deconstruction and reconstruction of the gospel in a living way, in a powerful way in your life, right? That's the journey of the Christian. That's the pilgrimage. And so I think Lewis can be helpful on that pilgrimage because, I mean, this round I read some poetry. I thought, wow, Lewis. I mean, I've seen different lenses of Lewis, right? So these voices, I guess, and this is kind of related to why I thought this was a very valuable introduction to Lewis, is because Lewis was so immersed in the medieval period, not like everything was great there. I mean, you can read There's a famous book called Early Modern Rituals, and it's all about like some of the terrible things that took place in Europe in the Middle Ages, like some of the crazy practices. You're like, how could these people be Christians and knew this stuff, you know? But then there's other things that are just beautiful, which we can't comprehend, which we need to reclaim. And I'm guessing that future generations will look back on ours and think like, how did these people not get this? Were they barbaric? Were they crazy? You know, they will look back on ours. How did the Christians not stand up at this point? Why did they not do this? And so this is why, again, maybe this is the theme. It's so important to have somebody like Lewis that awakens us to our own historical situation. And I did want to give you this quote by Wilhelm Dilthey, who was a 19th century German philosopher, who talks about Nachleben, which is the capacity to think as a real inhabitant of thought, of the thought world of another time. And as a Christian, you're both drawn to other Christians from other historical periods, but then you also, if you do it justice, it'll actually awaken you in ways you couldn't have been awakened if you were not true to that. If we just impose ourselves, if you just make C.S. Lewis this, you know, North American evangelical that, you know, is living right now versus this guy that's smoking a pipe. And already we're like, well, we don't do that. I don't see Pastor Josh smoking a pipe. You know, smoking a pipe and, you know, I mean, someone that's a little strange. It's like the poetry. He pushes your expectations of what Christianity is and isn't in a way that can help you be aware of your own commitments and the way in which you're following Christ. So, but Dilthey says this, within my own experience, as in that of most people today, the possibility of experiencing religious states of mind is narrowly restricted. So he's writing as someone who's doesn't really believe religion can do much. He's kind of secular in his outlook. Yet when I make my way through the letters and writings of Luther, I experience a religious event of such eruptive force, of such energy, such a matter of life and death, that it transcends the possible lived experience of anyone today. In short, we humans limit and are determined by the realities of life and therefore are only set free by historical understanding. So if you're a secular German, you have no clue about the power of religion unless you immerse yourself in the writings of Luther. And if you do, if you really gave yourself to that, you could become aware of the power of religion, which your own secular, you know, German society will not let you know about today, you know. And the same thing's true. So that's called Nachleben. Leben is the German word for when you enter to another life. So I hope you enter to Lewis's life. Hope he's your Nachleben. So. Yeah, one more. We'll take one more, and then I have to go, unfortunately.
You mentioned the past, looking back at the past, the thing about the historians, and I like that because, you know, a phrase I heard growing up was the worst place for a man to park his car is in the past. I don't know what it means. It always stuck with me. I'm still trying to figure it out. But I always knew that when you're looking back, you can't look forward. But it was such a great justification that you read that he says historians are more equipped to look at things objectively.
Yes.
Which I always try to do. It's hard for me to get into political discussions with my friends because I'm more looking at what the whole human experience is than just these 20 or 30 years, and we don't even know what they'll mean in the future and all that. I'm wondering how to reconcile spending mm-hmm. so much time looking mm-hmm. at where we are and what it means, mm-hmm. but still taking responsibility of where we're supposed to go. The man with the one eye, mm-hmm. he's not from that world anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean we just die?
Mm-hmm.
Or what from that,
mm-hmm.
what do we use our past
mm-hmm.
to blaze into our
yeah.
future? Because that's the thing that I
yeah.
struggle with.
Yeah, and I have to say, this idea that we just simply re-pristinate the past, I think is also just as terrible. You can become the kind of person, and I meet a lot of Christians that know church history that do this, and they just want to slam history in reverse as if that's the answer. And we don't live in the middle of the 20th century where modernism is we live in postmodernism, you know, and now we're even living with